Mr. McQuillan, reel one. Can you tell me, first of all, how you came to get the call to go to Belsen?
Yes, I was in the Royal Army Medical Corps in the Middle East, and then flew into Europe. And at the end of hostilities, we were asked to volunteer for a special task, which was, they wouldn't tell us the nature of the task or the details of the task, rather that we give a blanket agreement to do a special work.
In what unit had you been working in when you got the call?
At that time, I was working in the 67th British General Hospital, which was a major 2,400-bedded hospital, and situated at that time in Hamburg, some 70 miles from Lübeck and about 100 miles north of Celle, which is close to Belsen concentration camp, Belsen DP camp.
So this was about April 1945?
April 1945. It went from April into May, because when I was seeking authority and to try to purchase some camera film facilities, this was films to record what I was seeing, the end of hostilities occurred, and overnight we were faced with where we had been in enemy-occupied territory. We were suddenly in after the end of hostilities, technically we were then at peace with Germany. This meant that the facilities should be made more easily available. So for this reason, I'm saying that I can locate the dates as probably the last 2 weeks in April and the first or second week in May. But Belsen was cleared by the end of May anyway. They cleared out the camp and they burnt it to the ground.
How big a group of you were asked to go?
This I can't remember. I imagine there were a number of, well, I can loosely describe as technicians. We were all class one tradesmen. we were all non-commissioned. And the other thing was that each one of us had to be able to speak two other languages apart from our native tongue. In some form, we had to be able to make ourselves understood and to understand. At least, and immediately we balked at this, and they said, don't worry about it. What we're talking about is, do you know your numbers? Do you know the normal day-to-day conversation? No matter how simple it is, no matter how much, even if you've got to think in English and translate, don't worry about it. We can put you down as having two other languages apart from you. And so for this reason, a number of us went. My guess is that about 12 of us went, but I'm not sure. And there's nothing in my records, my autobiographical records, that gives me the exact number.
How did you get there?
By lorry from 67th General. This was laid on. There was some trouble about it, but whether we should wait for a Swedish lorry to come down to pick us up, since this was a Swedish financed arrangement, as we understood it. Bearing in mind, I wasn't a commission officer, therefore, much of the information I'll give you now is from a NCO's point of view and not from an officer's point of view. So I can't speak with any authority, any military authority.
What was the name of the Swedish organisation which you were joining?
The International Hospital Rehabilitation Unit, number 24. I'm not too sure it's 24 or 25, but I think it was 24.
What did you find when you got there?
I found that when we got there, we were offloaded at the lorry, and we were at a large German barracks. This is because they're immediately obvious, because they're always built to a one pattern. Brick built, three-story building, always in the same style. So we were in a German barracks, and enclosing a very large square. The square would be something about a quarter mile by a quarter mile, something like this, the square. At least that size, probably bigger.
Were you sent in to do the work straight away?
No, we were asked to see the Swedish medical authority, who was a doctor. And he explained to us what would be expected of us. We didn't arrive there until the evening, and we were expected to start up at first light the following morning.
Can you remember anything of the briefing he gave you?
Yes, various things about the work. That we it would be most unlikely, even if we'd had a lot of experience, as I had in postmortems and mortuaries and in operating theatres, it was unlikely that we would not be moved by the sights and the man's inhumanity to man is the best way to describe it. We would be moved by this, but it should not affect us to such an extent that we could not carry on with the work. We were told that it would be a period not exceeding 1 month, that we would be working flat out in some time, about 400 cases in the area that I worked in, about 400 females a day on average, and that was probably the higher quartile of the average, but it would vary. Some days there would probably be very few, there'd be more men than women, and we segregated them, the Swedish segregated them, because passing them through the chambers, you want two different methods, one for washing females and cleaning females. And this is delousing and disinfesting. There is a difference between the two. And to make sure that the patients who went, the inmates from Bergen-Belsen, who were accepted and on our say-so, and went forward to Sweden by ship from Lübeck, would not take with them any diseases or any problems, medical problems, that could arise and could react against the Swedish population. So the arrangement was that we would be put onto, the inmates would be put onto an island. Stockholm consists of about 230 islands. And they would use one or more islands for this work, and keep the people on that, essentially one form, if you like, of barrier, medical barrier, in case of diseases. Nonetheless, everybody caught something, everyone who worked there caught something. Sorry, I digressed though from the original point. What else was on the original briefing was that we would be passing these people through to Sweden, or we would take them to the ship, and then our job was finished. Once we passed them onto the ship, back in Kelsey, and we finished then. And in fact, we found that we couldn't do that. What we had to do, we were so busy and inundated with people, with cases, that you were working all the time in one area. Bearing in mind, of course, that you had to disinfest and delouse yourself, or be deloused two or three times a day to make sure that you didn't catch any diseases yourself. I ended up with yellow jaundice and infective hepatitis. And in fact, I had been flown back to England and did 6 months flat on my back because it's extremely dangerous. It wasn't just the kidneys, it was the liver as well. for 6 months. I was quite ill. But everybody who was there, all the other people who were there, to the best of my knowledge, were all caught some disease or other, to a varying or lesser degree. Unfortunately, we didn't stay together, and I lost them because I was sent on my aircraft. But
why do you think you got the disease in spite of all the precautions you took?
Two ways. I'm not sure. I may have been very unfair to the Belsen inmates in that it may not have been them at all. After we finished at Belsen, I went back to the unit at the 67th General, who had by this time moved up from Hamburg to Rendsburg on the German Schleswig-Holstein border into Denmark. And to give us some, we were all shattered mentally and to some degree. We didn't think we were, but we were, and it affected us tremendously. And we thought that this was unique, that Bergen-Belsen was probably the only camp in the world. At least I didn't. I thought this was, I didn't know then that there were hundreds of such places, and there still are in many countries of the world, in South America, in South Africa, in the Far East, that are still in the same condition that we met with Belsen inmates, probably far worse. But to give us some sort of return to normality, after I turned return to the 67, I kindly put the state back into the office the other day. They said, look, have a few days off. Go to a small place on the coast. I'm just trying to think what the name of the place was. It's a well-known watering place. I'll think of it later. And I was swimming there, coast to shore, and I noticed a number of lumps that were floating in the water. When they came close enough, this had been a prison ship that had been bombed by the Allies, so the rumour is. I never found out the truth of this. And these people, these bodies had floated up and were floating in, and they were coming in shore. So we organised getting these out of the water. I may have caught this infected hepatitis off those bodies. I don't know. You can't be sure. You can't be sure because of the long period prior to the dictates for the virus to develop.
This was in the Baltic, was it?
In the Baltic, yes. Yeah. It's on the. It faces the Travemünde. 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 Travemünde.
Can you give some more details of the work you did rescuing those bodies? Because it sounds as though it's the Kapalkona incident.
Could be.
I've interviewed people who were concerned with it.
Yeah. I can't tell you much about it except that those bodies that we could rescue, we did. The only thing we found was that when a body has been in the water for some time, all of these bodies, without exception, are floating bottom uppermost. With whatever gases were still in the abdomen, we're keeping them afloat. The head and the legs were both submerged. What we did, but as we pulled them ashore, sometimes they disintegrated. We thought it was far more important to find out whether anyone was still alive, and therefore we left those to one side. I never did see what happened to those afterwards, and I can't remember now. I know lorries arrived, military lorries arrived, and they were German lorries, but who they were working for, I don't know. Because you took over German lorries, you know, willy-nilly at that time. You could just almost, with a British uniform, you could almost stop a lorry and commandeer it for any military purpose. As long as you had justification to do so. And you didn't need to be a town major or someone like this in rank. You know, you could be, at that time, all I had were two bands on the arm, nothing else.
Could you see the wounds on the bodies?
No. No, I didn't see the wounds. I can't remember them. All I remember was that they'd been in the water for long enough that it was difficult to say what had caused the death. Except that there seemed to be an explosion. I've got in the back of my mind that there was an explosion. But that's all. That's the only thing I can tell you about.
Were any living people rescued?
No. We didn't find one living person at all.
How many bodies were pulled out about?
Now it's too far back in history, 50 years ago. It's difficult to know. I would estimate it took us a couple of hours to get these out. On a hot day, hot afternoon, and the evening. We were still there in the evening. I would imagine about 4 hours we were there in total. I don't know.
This was May 1945?
May 1945, yeah.
Now, coming back to Bergen-Belsen, what was the procedure for the disinfecting that you underwent three times a day?
You joined the walking, well, we didn't show the walking cases, and as though you come from Bergen-Belsen yourself. So you just joined in with them, you stripped off everything, put it through the pigeonholes. This is the one piece overall delousing suit, which was an overall that covered your shoes or sandals, all your clothing. We only wore vest and pants. And in a monk's cowl over the top of your head, drawn tight with a drawstring. And you took this off, put it into the chain, into the pigeonholes, and you put your own vest and pants in, which were numbered. We used to use a large number on them. It was the easiest way. You couldn't put your name on it, but you didn't have time to do this sort of thing. And then that made sure that you got your own vest and pants back afterwards. The overalls, it didn't matter whose overalls you got, so they were disinfected and steamed and dried with hot air. They used a dry hot air. They used hot air blowers. They were very well organized, the Swedish people, who were in charge of this camp. But they wanted us there for one particular purpose. This was to be able to give lie to the stories that the inmates had got, and that was that they would be put to death either by acid showers or by being sent to a gas chamber. We had no gas chambers, and we certainly didn't have acid showers. But this meant that you had to overcome this hysteria. And in many cases, this was open panic, where the women really believed, and once you start to panic, it doesn't matter even these days, if you start to panic, it can develop very quickly. And it's extremely difficult to control. So the idea was that if they saw the British medical cap badge, they were happy. They knew straight away that they were in safe hands. I was most touched by this. I've never seen anything like this before. I was so proud of the medical corps emblem.
Did the inmates think the Swedes might be Germans?
Yes, because they were wearing the overalls that we were wearing, these delousing suits, on the dirty side. Don't let me give you the wrong impression. Delousing suits were worn by everybody there. Two Swedish people I was working with, they ignored it. They just wore one pair of pants, and this was all that they did, and kept changing the pants. But they totally ignored anything else. They just worked barefooted, bare-legged, just with a pair of pants on, nothing on the top at all. And they said that they could keep themselves clean. Every time you went through the delousing, you had to have your head done as well. This is pure methylated spirits poured onto your head. Rubbed in, they could rub it in more into people who were not ex-Belsen people, obviously. But rub it in, and then to wash it off with a very mild disinfecting soap. Then rinse it off, and then dry it. you could drive yourself, obviously. The walking wounded, if you can call them that, used to drive themselves if they could, if they were capable. Where there were stretchers, then obviously this is what we were there for, as trained nurses to undertake this work, to do this work.
Were you personally just dealing with women, or women and men?
I was put there, the Swedish doctor on original briefing said, please stay in one position. If you find that you need assistance, or you need to leave, apart from going around the denouncing chamber yourself, you know, two or three times a day, whenever you've got a slight easement, you know, when the crowd died down a bit, then you went through. This was to try to make sure that as many people were being attended to as were available. You know, as the people came through, the aim was to try to deal with them as quickly as possible, to get them onto the ship as soon as possible. Every hour that we were dealing with them, mercifully, the weather was, it was a warm time and we had no rain, but we knew that we were building in a high degree of surgical shock into these victims. And the proof of this, of course, was all too obvious by the number of people who died on us. They died whilst they were still there. Many of them just gave up and died. They just couldn't. They were being dealt with kindly, and even this was too much. They just were so unused to it, because many of the people who were in Belsen was only a 2-year stint anyway. They'd come from other camps. They'd come from other. Belsen was essentially a displaced persons camp, but for Jews who were going to be traded up, you know, against Germans, high German prisoners, so they could be, you know, what do you call it when you're switched over?
Exchanged.
These were exchanged, but we found out most of the people had come from other concentration camps where they had done many years. Some of them had done a great number of years. This was the difficulty to a person like myself, who was fully trained in medical matters, but was unused to having the unique problems that arose with both Belsen inmates. So some of them had only been incarcerated in camps for in Belsen only, and probably only a few months, and were literally walking. They were almost as healthy as you and I, but others were at death's door, and in fact died on us, sometimes before we could even denounce them. But usually you denounce them, disinfested them, you clean them up, you dried them off with hot air, and then with baby toweling. This was a super soft baby toweling, marvellous toweling. But when you then put a blanket over them, and these were not the rough army blankets, they were very good Swedish blankets. Sorry, they were blankets that were supplied by the Swedes. I don't know where they came from. But they were very good quality blankets. The idea was then you had to keep them to reduce the amount of shock. So you put them on clean stretchers, dry stretchers, and you handle them as little as possible. Left them to convalesce for a few hours to get over the trauma of the disinfestation and the cleaning. And then they were transferred by the next lorry that took them forward to the ship. In some cases, we would go with the cases if they were really ill. We would then stay with those cases and go to the ship, see that they were put onto the ship and start, you know, make sure that they were still alive when we got them onto the ship. Others, where they could manage on their own, then we stayed back and helped the other ones that were coming along. What was always in the back of your mind was, how many more are coming? No idea. Nobody could tell you how many more. Not even the Swedes in there, methodical. And most methodical method of most methodical attitude to the whole thing. It looked as though this exercise had been fully planned. Yet it couldn't be planned all that long ahead. But nonetheless, the Swedes were—they didn't make many mistakes on this. But even then, we still found out that they couldn't tell us how many more cases were to come. And it wasn't until probably the last day of April or the first couple of days of May before we began to run down on patients. Then you were asking, were we on, was I on women only? Yes, you stayed in one position if you could. If you couldn't, well, your number of cases suddenly died down on you. This was because the lorries coming in were bringing only men. So the thing to do was to, not to waste your time. It was, time was too precious. You were working every hour that of daylight that you could work. This was from about after breakfast. And breakfast was a running buffet, Swedish running buffet. And you had breakfast about 6. And you started work about 6:30. And you kept going until dark, which is about 8:30, 9:00 at night. You just kept going right through. But when the cases began to run down, the idea was then to go around and to work on the men's side. So I did do some work on the men's side as well. The men seemed to have less hysteria, but they were nonetheless equally deprived and were equally shocked and were equally close to death, if you like, as a result of being incarcerated in camps.
How did hysteria show itself? By shouting and screaming?
It depends. In the case, I would have said just by shouting and screaming. But when you think about it, one of the women particularly showed extreme agitation. And it wasn't shouting. It was just that she was, her muscles tensed up. And since we were looking for any signs of people dying on us, you know, because there's no point in proceeding with someone who's dying. The thing to do was move out of the way. I know it sounds, you know, pretty ghastly, but this, we were so short of time. The thing to do was to get rid of those people once they had been pronounced dead. Get them out of the way. Get on with the people who were still alive. They were the people that we were trying to save. You earn no medals by trying to save a dead person. Although, this doesn't mean to say that we didn't accord them the natural respect that one gives to. This was because our medical training taught us, you know, the normal respect that you give to a dead body.
But you were suggesting they went rigid as though they had...
This woman went rigid, and I thought, I wonder what on earth has happened. And because I couldn't talk to her in her language, I think she was Hungarian, she always spoke her own language, and she was not in a position to talk anyway. She was at a high state of agitation, such that she was incapable, I think, of speech. But I signaled for one of the multilingual people there. I think they were UNRWA, or they became UNRWA, United Nations Rape and Rehabilitation Relief men who worked from the United Nations later. But these people were capable of speaking at least 20 languages fully, and I don't mean just speaking them. They were fully conversant in these languages. It was a gift. I asked the Swedish doctor about it, and he said, it's a gift.